New Testament, Matthew, Mark, second book in the New Testament, and we're continuing our study. And by the way, if you don't have a Bible, there's always one in the entryway that you can grab, or maybe the table just outside. But we're continuing our study of the Gospel of Mark that we've been in this fall. And when we read the Bible, I hope you love reading the Bible. There's just so many questions we can't ask, and sometimes they're serious, and sometimes we're just curious about what in the world the Bible is talking about. When the earth was created, was it a literal 6 days, or is that a picture of larger periods of time? Did Adam and Eve's children marry each other? Awkward, probably. If King David was such a godly man, why was his personal life and his family such a mess? And was King Solomon happy with 300 wives and 700 concubines? Which, to my way of looking at it, is just a bit excessive by a couple of hundred. I don't know. It seems kind of crazy to me. And how many of them did he know their names? That's what I'm really curious about. The 12 disciples, did they have families? Did they have children? What was it like? And when Jesus and the disciples were camping, as they often did, around the campfire, was Jesus ever funny? Joking, maybe a bit irreverent. These are the sorts of questions I ask. And they're important questions, maybe at one level. But the most important question for all of us that read the Bible is this: who is Jesus Christ? It is the central question, really, of all the scriptures. Old Testament, the longings for the Messiah, and New Testament, as we look backwards, who is this man? Well, the four Gospels all answer that question and come at it in a slightly different way. Matthew makes it very, very clear when you read his Gospel that Jesus is the fulfillment of all the Old Testament longings, all the Old Testament scriptures. Luke gives us all kinds of details that we don't get in the other Gospels. It's very, very accurate as to who Jesus is. John fills in some of the gaps that the other three Gospel writers leave out. And John gives us a lot of the statements of Jesus. And we have all the I am statements. I am the bread of life. I am living water. And these sorts of statements that Jesus have. But Mark, where we are, is the in-your-face Gospel. It's the Gospel that is written to provoke, frankly, a personal crisis in each one of us. And it's meant to provoke a personal crisis in us today. Who is this Jesus? And from chapter 1, verse 1, if you remember back a few weeks when we began, Mark takes it and drops Jesus right in our laps. Chapter 1, verse 1, he says, "Is this the Son of God? What are you going to do about it? Do you believe it?" Well, today we're going to look at four miracles in three separate little stories. It's a fair amount of scripture reading, so I'm going to let you stay seated today, and you might be thankful for that. But there are four miracles which result in either fear or faith. And we want to take a look at why those involved in these scenes responded in either fear or faith. And then we have to ask the question, how are we responding? Are we going to respond to this Jesus who Mark is putting right in front of us in fear or in faith? Some of you might be thinking, why would anybody be afraid of Jesus? He's so gentle. He's so kind. He's so loving. He's so accepting. Well, get ready. In these four stories, we're going to see the disciples at the beginning freak out when Jesus calms a storm. They're beside themselves. In the next story, there's a demonic man who's healed in the village of Gennesaret, and the people are so afraid of this thing that they say to Jesus, "Hey, would you leave? Would you go away?" There's a woman who's healed of her menstrual bleeding, and she responds in tremendous fear. She's terrified when Jesus turns and says, "Hey, who touched me?" And then Jairus, who has a daughter who dies, is a brokenhearted and fearful dad. So let's begin and look at these stories. They're so fascinating. The storm. Mark chapter 4, verse 35. "On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let's go across to the other side.'" Now I need to stop here and point something out. Each of these stories, they're going to the other side of the lake, and it can almost seem like, can't you just decide which one side of the lake you want to be on? They're back and forth. So, true confession, how many of you go to Costco at times twice a day? Yeah, I know, because, yeah, I've seen you there. And that's the idea. So you're going to get this back and forth. They're going for on both sides of the Sea of Galilee, back and forth. And so that's what's happening here. And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a cushion. And they woke him, and they said to him, "Teacher, don't you care? We're perishing." He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The Sea of Galilee, 680 feet below sea level. It's a geographical anomaly. Directly to the north of the Sea of Galilee is Mount Hermon, 9,200 feet, which is snow-capped most of the year. On the east would be the Golan Heights, which are made famous by some of the wars that have taken place in the Middle East, a high plateau. It's a perfect geographical place for storms to come and rapid winds to come. And we know from reading in the Gospels and even from today that the Sea of Galilee can go very quickly from a calm place to a terrifying place. That's what happens in this story. Jesus is asleep in the midst of a crazy storm. And some of you are married to a person or have a roommate who's just like that. I mean, it's not infrequent for me to wake up in the morning and say to Donna, "Could you believe all the noise last night? I mean, did you hear the sirens or the party down the street?" And she'll go, "What noise?" She's like Jesus. Jesus is sound asleep on the cushion. I want you to notice, there's sarcasm here in the passage. This is spicy language, folks. Don't miss this when you read the Bible. The disciples say, "Teacher, don't you care we're perishing?" New Living Translation, "Don't you care we're about to drown?" I mean, they're upset. Now, there's a subtext here that we could easily miss. In the Old Testament, and there's a rich tradition in the Old Testament, only God the Father is the one who can calm the storms. And there was a real terror of storms and of the sea in particular of ancient people. You might read this if you're taking any notes, write down Psalm 107, and that'd be one place. Maybe take again a look at the story of Jonah where it's the Father who intervenes. But what Mark is doing is he's saying to the readers, to us who are hearing this story, in the Old Testament, it was the Father, only the Father, who could calm the storm. And now look who's calming the storm. Jesus does what the Father does. And that's meant to tell us something about Jesus. Now, there's something important here for us to remember. A lot of times you will, if you hear somebody preach on this passage or teach on this passage, they will turn the storm into a metaphor for our life and talk about how the storm teaches each of us to endure the storms of life. But I want you to know, the emphasis in this story is not so much on helping us endure the storms of our own life, but rather pointing to the identity of Jesus as the Son of God. There are other wonderful passages in the Scripture that teach us that indeed God will walk with us and help us through the storms of life, but we should probably look elsewhere for that. The disciples are in spiritual diapers. They simply don't get who Jesus is. And there's this very funny interchange. If you look at it in verses 40 and 41, note the connection between fear and faith. This is where we're going this morning, fear and faith. He says, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear. You see it? Fear, faith. Why are you still frightened? And then Mark says, and they were filled with great fear. So here in this story of God's nearness and the power and the authority of Jesus in calming the storm, it's not something reassuring that happens, but something that is absolutely terrifying. Second story, Legion. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of Gerasenes, and when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately, and there's that word that Mark uses over and over again, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he often had been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles to pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs, on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. To me, that sounds an awful lot like fear. This is a tormented guy. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out to the country. Now a great herd of pigs were feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us into the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down to the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled. They're frightened. And told in the city and the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had legions sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Now, a little bit of a backdrop here, the emphasis on Mark saying that they were clothed, that this man was clothed. Luke's gospel gives us a little bit more information. Luke tells us as he was cutting and crying out and screaming and tormented that he was doing so naked. So he's just running around naked. So Mark lets us know that he is clothed. Lost my place here. And they were afraid. Verse 16. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to come to their home group. They began to beg Jesus to depart from their region, to leave. And he was getting into the boat. The man who'd been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how much he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's a region of 10 Gentile cities, how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. In our first story, Jesus calms a violent storm, and now he meets a man who has a violent storm inside of him. This is now Mark's third exorcism so far. We're only in chapter 5. And Jesus, we see over and over again, does miracles because, in fact, he is God. And the miracles are meant to force us to ask, who is this? Now notice what Mark does. Immediately when the demon-possessed man sees Jesus, the demons absolutely know who Jesus is. "Oh, you're the Son of the Most High God." And they begin to barter with him. This is a power story. There is a power struggle going on here. And one of the things that's really important, if you're newer to the reading of the Bible, if you're newer to the Christian life, you may say, "Well, there's so many miracles. I have a hard time with miracles." Well, if you have a hard time with that, then you'll have a hard time with Jesus. In 1969, I was in junior college. I was 19 years old, and I went to junior college as opposed to university because I was a surfer, and we went to junior college. And I took a class that was called Religion and the Bible. And that was kind of the beginning of the movement that I think is still popular of studying the Bible as literature, which is a good thing at one level. And the professor gave an assignment to all of us that said, I want you to write a paper on, did Jesus really walk on the water? John chapter 6 is that story. It's a brief story, but it's relatively well known, and there's been a lot of artists who have done renditions of this. And the assignment was, did Jesus walk on the water? Yes or no? And so I'm thinking, man, I'm going to kill it. You know, I'm 19 years old. This is right up my alley. And this is my first little college paper. And so I wrote a paper, and I wrote in the affirmative, and I marshaled all kinds of evidence and philosophic rationalizing about the whole thing. And it was brilliant. And got a B. not happy about the B. And so I went to the professor and I said, hey, I think my research was solid. There's no real mistakes in the paper. And I gave a reasoned approach that Jesus, in fact, could have and did walk on the water. And he said, no, you got a B because it's impossible for any man to walk on water. So he had bracketed out the possibility of God's intervention in this world. And I guess I gently remind you, if you have a worldview that says God cannot intervene, if you have a closed system, then you'll have a very difficult time with the Bible. But indeed, we see here that Jesus, the Son of the Most High God, does in fact involve himself in changing the natural order miraculously because in fact he's God. Now notice a few things about this story. And it's an unusual story. Let's just admit it right there. The strength of the demonized man is contrasted with the strength and the power of Jesus. It's a power confrontation, and Jesus clearly wins. So after the healing, you had a calm lake in the first story. Now you have a calm man. Jesus has authority not over the natural world and the lake, but also he has authority over the supernatural world, the demonic. Now what about the pigs? What about the pigs? You know, for the animal rights crowd, this story is kind of a bummer. I get that. And if you're thinking of Piglet or Porky Pig or, you know, Miss Piggy or Babe or any of these caricatures of pigs, sorry. But it's a perplexing story. And frankly, commentators have a field day with it. And at the end of the day, I don't think they really know what to do. So I had a lot of people say, hey, what, are you going to tell us about the pigs? And like, well, no, I don't think so. If nothing else, it shows the destructive power of the demonic and the forces of evil, that they indeed try to destroy the man, but they end up destroying these pigs. Now, one of the big questions is, as these evil spirits are cast into the pigs and then the pigs die, where do those evil spirits go? And the answer is cats. Oh, yeah. And this is why in all the rest of history, cats are the way they are. Okay, cat people, don't be mad at me. I'm just teasing. I want you to think about this story for a second. Some of the people in this area, in these villages and small towns, knew this man. Some of them might have been a brother or an uncle or a cousin. This is not a stranger. Some of them remember, oh yeah, when we were 8 years old, we used to play in the dusty streets of our village. And now, this man who had been demonized and led this horrible life has been healed. I want you to notice that in both of these first two stories, neither of these miracles, at least initially, lead to faith. The disciples are totally freaked out. They're fearful. The townspeople who have seen this demoniac man, legion, healed, they say, hey, Jesus, could you just go do it somewhere else? I mean, like, we don't want you around here. And only the healed man is the one who has a bit of faith here. Disciples are more fearful of Jesus' power over the storm than the storm. And the village people seem to be more fearful of Jesus' power than the demon-possessed man, clothed in his right mind. And they were fearful. But the healed man, who formerly was tormented by demons, begs to be with Jesus, and the townspeople beg Jesus to leave. So there's a contrast here. Fear and faith. We're starting to see a pattern. Fear results in fleeing from Jesus. Faith results in following Jesus, being with him. C.S. Lewis talks about his own conversion. Maybe you can relate to this. And he uses the metaphor of legion, talking about his life, what it was like before he met Jesus. And he says, my life was a zoo of lust, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. My name was Legion. Surprised by joy. I would recommend it to any of you. Probably because this man is a Gentile in a Gentile area, Decapolis, these 10 villages or towns. Jesus says, I want you to go back and I want you to tell everybody what the Lord has done for you. Last story, two daughters. And when Jesus had crossed again, here we go, back and forth, in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him and he was beside the sea. Then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, and seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, my little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live. And he went with him. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, who'd suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard the reports about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, if I touch even his garments, I will be made well. And immediately the flow of blood dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power had gone out of him, immediately turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And his disciples said to him, you see the crowds pressing around you? And you say, who touched me? And he looked around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear, trembling, and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, and these are some of the most tender words in the Gospels, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. And while he was speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. I think that's the most important verse that we'll see this morning. Do not fear, only believe. And he allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. They came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and Jesus saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing. And when he had entered, he said to them, why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but sleeping. And they all laughed at him. But he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him, Peter, James, and John, and went in where the child was. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, Talitha kumi, which means little girl, I say to you, arise. And immediately the girl got up and began to walk, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement, and he strictly charged them that no one should know this. And he told them to give her something to eat. Two daughters are contrasted. Let's again notice what happens in this story. You have two miracles. One of a 12-year-old girl who has died and resurrected, Jairus' daughter, and a woman who's had menstrual bleeding and great pain for 12 years. Both of the women are in desperate circumstances with no sign of hope. Verse 30, look at it. It's just such an ironic question. Who touched me? Now, you need to picture not a polite group of people like we've got here this morning, but I wouldn't call it a mob, but it's a crowd that's a bit out of control. This is the Middle Eastern folks, and they're crowding around Jesus, and everybody's upset, and people are touching. Don and I last Christmas, a week after Christmas, went to London to take our 13-year-old grandson to see football games, real football games, soccer. And we had a blast, but one of the scary things, man, is getting on the subways in Europe. And we had one time we were coming back from somewhere, I can't remember, and it was about 5:15, 5:20, and everybody was getting off work, and we were in central London. And we were so terrified of getting separated from Tully, because if you're in a foreign city and you got a 13-year-old kid that he'd never been practically out of Goleta, you know, what's going to happen? And so we're on the subway, and every time it would stop, the doors would open, and we're thinking, more people are getting on, and they would just squeeze in. And eventually, Donna's kind of separated from me, and Tully's separated, and I can't see him, even though I'm tall, and I'm looking for him. And it's like, man, this is crazy. And I'm having more personal body contact and breath and touching and all the rest with British people than I've ever wanted in my life. It was frightening. And it would be like saying in that context, hey, somebody touch me. Everybody's touching everybody. And this woman who touches Jesus, Jesus knows something happens, and he says, who touched me? Both of these stories bring Jesus into contact with women who are ceremonially unclean. One has a menstrual flow of blood, and the other is a dead corpse. And it's worth noting that it doesn't seem to bother Jesus in the least. The bleeding woman had a social stigma. In addition to her shame, she had physical pain and she was broke financially. And once again, you see that fear and faith are at the very heart of these stories. Verse 34 and 33, she came in fear and trembling. Her fear and trembling was met with tender compassion with Jesus. Daughter, your faith has healed you. And Jesus is pointing out it's not the touch that healed her, but her faith that healed her. And then in verse 36, again, what I think is the key verse in this whole section, Jesus says to Jairus, don't fear, only believe. I want to make a little bit of application before I invite you to the Lord's table. One of the things I want you to notice, and it just jumps off the page if you've been paying attention to these stories, is that all of the characters in these stories had problems, each and every one of them. And it reminds us that Jesus is anxious to come to people whose lives are in a mess and people whose lives need a spiritual doctor. We looked at this a few weeks ago in Mark 2. Don't ever forget it. I'm reading from the message. But when the teachers of religion saw Jesus, who were Pharisees, and saw him eating with tax collectors and sinners, they asked his disciples, why does he eat with such scum? When Jesus heard this, he told them, healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. I have not come to call those who think they're righteous, but those who know they are sinners. Now, I always worry about people who are newer to the Christian faith, or maybe you're here this morning and you're looking at the Christian faith. Welcome. But there's a real misconception sometimes. I think, well, if I'm going to know this Jesus, if I'm going to read the Bible, if I'm going to be a Christian, somehow I need to get all cleaned up before I do that. And that's exactly the opposite. We come to Christ so that he would cleanse us to receive his grace. He wants people who know they're dirty. The disciples have trouble. They got fear, confusion. They're spiritual babies. They just don't get Jesus. The demon-possessed man, he's a cutter. It's kind of self-evident. He's naked. He's tormented, ostracized from family, friends, his village. The hemorrhaging woman, she's an outcast. She's financially broke. She's in physical pain. Jairus' daughter, well, he's dead and you got a grieving, she's dead rather, and you have a grieving father. Jesus comes to people who are in trouble, people who need a doctor. If you have trouble in life, and frankly, who doesn't? You're exactly the kind of person that Jesus wants to care for. So you know the term, I'm going to really date myself here, Sunday best. You know that term? And the idea of Sunday best, it's an old term and I don't think it's used much, but if you're going to go to church, you know, you put on your best clothes, your best, whatever you got that's the best, you put on your Sunday best and you go to church. And it's obvious that you have not done that, which is fine. But I've often thought that this whole idea of getting dressed up, and it's not part of our culture as a beach culture, but in other places it might be, getting dressed up to go to church somehow misses the point. We come as people who need to be cleansed. A few years ago, I was doing a wedding up in Los Olivos at St. Mark Episcopal Church. I don't know if you've been there. It is one of the most stunning buildings. And I was doing it with, I guess his title would be a priest, because it's the Episcopal system. And I'm in his office waiting for this guy because we had to figure out how to do this wedding together. And I've got my suit and tie on, and yes, I have a suit and tie. And standing there, and this guy walks in, and I was kind of taken back. He had a soiled t-shirt that has some grass stains on it, a pair of dirty jeans. He had long salt and pepper hair. Not that I was jealous, but guy looked pretty impressive. But he's filthy. He's a mess. And I'm like, we introduce ourselves and shake hands, and he goes over to a sink that's in his office, and he washes up and he washes his face, a little soap and water, and he takes some water and he wonderful head of hair and moves it all back and kind of made me go like, yeah. But anyway, so he gets it all back and he goes over to a stand and there's this absolutely gorgeous white robe, thick cloth. I imagine the thing cost a fortune. And he takes it and he puts it on. And then he takes this brightly colored stole with all kinds of embroidery on it and he puts it around his neck. I'm thinking, and like, 10 seconds, this guy looks way better than me. But I knew what was underneath. And the Lord knows what's underneath in each of our lives. No matter how great we might look on the outside. In each of these four miracles, we're confronted with a Jesus who has power over every area of life. The first one is over nature. He calms the storm. The second one is over the spiritual world. He casts out the demons. The third one is over life. He heals this bleeding, hemorrhaging woman. And the last one is over death itself as he raises Jairus' daughter. I said it at the beginning. I want to say it again. This gospel is meant and is written to provoke a personal crisis in each of our lives. As to whether or not we believe that Jesus is in fact the Son of God, the Son of the Most High God, and whether or not we will relate to him out of fear or faith. And everybody here today has to ask this simple question. Fear leads to fleeing, faith leads to following. Where are you? The real threat, I believe, to Christian faith doesn't come from a lack of knowledge, but rather from doubt and fear. You know, it's one thing to encounter a tame Jesus who's good with children and lambs. It's another thing to encounter a Jesus who has absolute authority over every area in our world. And many of us relate to Jesus out of fear, I believe, because we want to be in charge of our life. We're control freaks. And if you wholeheartedly follow Jesus in faith, some of you might be thinking, well, will he wreck my life? I like to be in control. Some of you think, well, he might put demands on my life that I can't meet or I don't want to meet. Are you afraid? Are you afraid of giving up control in your life? And maybe in the process of, even though you're in church this morning, like, hey, I'm going to get out of here pretty quick, get in my car, and be back in charge of my own life. In these stories, I want you to notice that those who were touched by Jesus, healed by him, can't wait to be with him. They don't flee. They want to follow. They want to be with him because they got the touch of God in their life. Faith leads to following. The tender compassion of Jesus, who in verse 36, look at it just one last time, it's so good. Don't fear, only believe. So, what's your posture this morning? I know you're all sitting there and I'm just about done, so don't worry. But what's your posture spiritually with God? And by posture, I mean, you know, if we're like this, that usually means we're defensive, right? And if we're like this, it means we're open and loving. And what's your posture spiritually? When Don and I, in the year 2000, we spent several months in a cattle ranch in Montana. We had a sabbatical. It was a wonderful time in our life. And we had a little cabin that looked out on this huge cattle field. There was about 200 plus head of cattle. Big mountains this way, big mountains this way, and a mountain behind us. And you know, Montana is, as we go into the dark, cold months in Santa Barbara, I want you to know that there are places in this country that are doggone cold. And Montana's one of them. From November 1st all the way through, there was always snow on the ground. It was always cold. It was really something. But I would get up every morning to make coffee for my lovely wife. And I'd look out at these cows that I thought, how could they live all night out in that field? It is so cold. And I would look at them, and cows are not real smart. Basically, they eat, and they don't do much. But every morning, I'd look at these cows, and they'd go over to a corner of the field that was the first place that the sun would hit when the sun came above this mountain. And they'd stand there, and normally cows would just kind of mill around, but all of them would turn sideways. They're big. So as the sun came over the mountain, it would hit the side of them and begin to warm them up. And their posture said so much about what they were longing for. And I just want to ask you, metaphorically here, what's your posture spiritually? Fear leads to fleeing. Faith leads to following. And Jesus invites us to stop being afraid and to follow this tender and compassionate Savior that longs to heal those who know they have a sickness. This is the point of the cross. Bread and wine that give testimony to the death and resurrection of Jesus. That he came in a body and he shed blood for forgiveness of our sins. And I want to invite you to come, and if you have faith, not with fear, but trusting, following, and saying, oh, thank you, Jesus, for being such a tender Savior. There'll be prayer teams on either side of the church and our prayer closet in the back. They'll pray with you about anything. Let's continue to worship and come in faith.